You're listening to DTFHN for March 11th, 2026. I'm your Proof by Construction host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website W section is half the point. Today is for the people who did the hard work before anyone was watching. Let's go. There's a particular kind of pain you only know if you've spent serious time inside a compiler. You make a change. A sensible change. A logical change. And the build system looks at you like you've insulted its mother. Dependency loops. Cascading analysis. The compiler doing work you never asked it to do. Pulling in half the standard library because you touched a type that touched a namespace, that touched something, that touched everything. I've been there. It's not subtle. Matthew Lug just merged a 30,000-line PR into Zig that fixes this at the root. Let's strip it down. What does a compiler actually need to know? If you declare a type and never instantiate it, never initialize a value of that type. Does a compiler need to analyze every field? First principle says no. The compiler should be lazy. It should do the minimum work required to verify what you're actually using. That's it. That's the whole insight. Zig's type resolution was not doing this. It was eager where it should have been lazy. So if you use the struct as a namespace, grabbed a constant off it, never touched its fields, the compiler still pulled in everything. Every field, every compile error lurking in there, every transitive dependency, work that wasn't necessary, treated as necessary. The fix sounds simple when you say it out loud. It took 3 months and 30,000 lines. The dependency loop improvements are where I get genuinely amused. Zig's old dependency loop errors were legendarily useless. You'd hit a cycle, the compiler would shrug, and you'd spend an afternoon bisecting your own suck graph by hand. The new messages actually tell you where the loop is. Node A depends on B for this field. B depends on A for this alignment query. Eliminate either one. Done. That's not a small thing. That's the difference between a tool that respects your time and one that treats debugging as your problem. The incremental compilation angle is the one to run forward. Incremental builds are only useful if the incremental part is actually incremental. If a small change doesn't trigger a full reanalysis cascade, the overanalysis bugs were breaking that guarantee. They're fixed now. Zig is pre-wom zero beles mach de nodding as rovers for his icing in the nigh, the max fight of the wad. Zig is pre-wom beles mach de nodding old and not to nodding to simply hear drawl. Before stabilization, that's the right frame. You want the hard rework to happen before the API promises calcify. Happy hacking indeed. Mover ah! Roan sold the TB Threadloom 3 for $50. They had warehouses full of them. A machine designed to replace bass players that no one wanted. That sounded nothing like a bass player. That was genuinely annoying to program. They wanted it gone. Musicians bought them because they were cheap. And then, somewhere in Chicago, someone turned up the resonance and accidentally invented Acid House. That's the question underneath this tutorial on building a TB-303 from scratch. And nobody's quite asking it directly. What exactly are we trying to recreate? The surname Thry wasn't beloved for sounding correct. It was beloved for sounding wrong. The squelch, the slide, the filter sweep that sounds like it's trying to say something in a language it hasn't mastered yet. That wasn't a design goal. That was an accident on top of an accident. Roland built a machine that failed. Musicians used it wrong, and the wrongness became the point. When comments arrived noting that This software 303 sounds very little like a 303. There's a layer of comedy in there that's almost architectural. The original 303 sounded very little like anything Roland intended either. One commenter goes straight to the historical record. Find an old iMac. Install Rebirth. Propellerhead's Rebirth from 1997 remains the canonical software tape. Decades of obsessive reverse engineering baked in. Another points to Jeskola TB303 from the Demoscene era, built by people who cared about accuracy the way archaeologists care about provenance. What this tutorial actually is. And the comments gently push back on the word build is a demonstration of synthesis concepts, filter design, resonance, accent circuits, the mechanics of why the 303 sounds the way it does. That's legitimately valuable. Understanding how the wrongness works is different from replicating it. And that distinction matters if you're learning synthesis from first principles. The schematics have been open for decades. Every hardware clone, every software emulator, every tutorial like this one. It's a community in meticulous, obsessive custody of an accident. Run that forward. The most influential bass machine in electronic music was a commercial failure that sold for $50. The knowledge of how it works is free. The community keeping it alive is rebuilding it from scratch, one tutorial at a time. Roland abandoned it. The community didn't. That's the whole story. There's a theme emerging in today's stories. Story 3 makes it explicit. What separates genuine urgency from manufactured panic? That's the question George Hotz put down this week. Quietly, without the usual algorithmic amplification his sharper takes receive. The context, the last few months have produced a particular flavor of content. AI agents replacing workers. If you haven't rebuilt your entire workflow around orchestrated language models, you're already obsolete. Someone bootstrapped a billion-dollar company using 69 agents this morning, and you ate breakfast like a normal person, and you are already behind. Podes calls this complete nonsense, and the argument he makes is precise. AI is the continuation of an exponential we've been riding for decades. It's search. It's optimization. These are powerful tools with known theoretical limits. Limits your CS professor probably covered. When people see AI and project science fiction onto it, they're pattern matching to a story, not the math. The elegance in his actual argument. The threat model isn't AI replacing humans. It's zero-sum games eating the people playing them. Rent seekers. People whose jobs consist of creating complexity for others, extracting fees from friction. Those jobs are genuinely at risk. Not because a transformer is smarter, but because larger players are consolidating the extraction. The AI narrative just makes the stock price go up. The exit isn't to optimize harder inside the zero-sum game. The exit is to stop playing it. Create more value than you consume. That's the whole framework. It doesn't require a particular tech stack, a particular workflow, a particular velocity of agent orchestration. It requires that when you leave a situation, people are better off than when you arrived. Communities that function well have always selected for this. One commenter pointed straight at the Bhagavad Gita. They weren't wrong. The bootstrap Zumango runs clean here. The anxiety machine is itself a rent-seeking operation. It sells fear of obsolescence to extract your attention, your subscriptions, your sense of self-worth. But the antidote is the same as it's always been. Build things. Share what you learn. Put more into the commons than you take out. Who can touch what you made? That's still the question that matters. The post will get less traction than the doom ones. Hotz knows this. He published it anyway. That's worth something. Story 4 is a complete tonal whiplash. And honestly, we're here for it. From the existential to the delightfully arcane. The strongest argument against this story is the one a commenter made directly. Unicode is bloated. Thousands of characters nobody uses. Relics from dead typesetting systems. Symbols that exist because some standards committee inherited them from ISO and nobody asked hard enough questions. If a character has been sitting in the spec for decades, and nobody could tell you what it means, maybe it shouldn't be there. That's a reasonable position. Hold it. Now run the actual history. U+237C was absorbed into Unicode from older standards, its meaning unattested. For years, the best anyone had was speculation. Then, in February 2025. Not from a Unicode consortium working group, not from a paid research team. A Wikipedia editor named Moyogo found a one-town side of 5e symbol catalog from the German type foundry H. Berthold AG. Page 7, right there in the scan, listed as azimut, azimut, direction, angle. The mystery dissolved in a document that had been sitting in a digitized archive, accessible to anyone with a browser and enough curiosity to look. Here's what that actually demonstrates. The knowledge existed. It was always there. In print catalogs from 1949, 1950, 1951, 1952, what was missing was the connective tissue, the digitization, the public archive, the open encyclopedia where someone could post a citation, anyone could verify. The fonts and use project linking to archived Berthold catalogs. Wikipedia's infrastructure for citations. All of it open. All of it collaborative. All of it free to reach. The commenter calling Unicode bloated is making an argument about standards governance worth taking seriously. But their evidence. That sat unexplained for so long, actually cuts the other way. The explanation existed in closed print catalogs for 75 years. It took open infrastructure to surface it. The architecture of openness did what no proprietary research effort had bothered to do. Now look at the glyph itself, a right angle with a line passing through it. The exact geometry of a light ray through a sextant. Measuring angle from the meridian. The engineers at Berthold in 1950 weren't being obscure. They were being precise. That precision survived in a typography catalog, waited for an archive, waited for a commons, and arrived intact. One Wikipedia editor, one digitized catalog, one afternoon of actual detective work. The tools exist. The knowledge is available. That's always been the condition. The question is whether anyone built the infrastructure to let you reach it. Story 5 is about someone building exactly the infrastructure. Cloudflare just opened a crawl endpoint that makes the open web easier to reach programmatically. The web was designed to be read by machines. HTTP, HTML links. The whole original stack assumed a parser could consume any page. Then the rendered web arrived. JavaScript-dependent pages that deliver a blank shell and fill themselves in through client-side execution. The machine-readable compact broke, getting clean text from the modern web stopped being a fetch request and became an infrastructure problem. What Cloudflare shipped is a headless browser farm with an orchestration layer in front of it. That description sounds simple. The implementation isn't. Run Chromium at scale. Wait for JavaScript hydration. Follow links without spiraling into redirect loops. Respect robots.txt and crawl delay directives. Convert rendered DOM to clean markdown. Return structured JSON from unstructured pages. Each of those steps is a solved problem in isolation. The hard part is the coordination, and the hardest part of coordination is doing it efficiently across repeated crawls of the same site. Military logistics works the same way. The road network that carries soldiers forward carries supply trains backward. The river crossing that enables advance enables withdrawal. The critical innovation in logistics isn't movement. It's the accounting layer. What's been moved? What's changed? What needs refreshing? Napoleon understood this. His failure in Russia wasn't strategy. It was supply chain, state management. Cloudflare's modified sense and MaxAge parameters are that accounting layer. Skip pages that haven't changed. Only fetch what's new. The second crawl of a site costs a fraction of the first. This matters for specific people doing specific work. A graduate student building a research corpus. A small team running private RAG over their own documentation ecosystem. A journalist monitoring a government site for changes over time. A developer who wants structured data from a site that doesn't offer an API. These people previously had two realistic paths. Build their own crawler and fight with JavaScript rendering for months, or pay enterprise rates for scraping infrastructure. Cloudflare opened a third path on the free tier. The comment thread flagged the irony. Cloudflare sells protection against bots and now sells a bot. And the point lands, but the response another commenter gave is the right one. The web was built to be indexed. Robots.txt is the consent mechanism. The crawl endpoint honors it. The question worth sitting with isn't whether this product is hypocritical. It's whether structured crawl access should require infrastructure at Cloudflare's scale at all, or whether it should be something anyone can point at any site and use. For now, the second answer just got easier to reach. From infrastructure scale to something more intimate, Pause Story 6 is about making voices and making them right. 2 to 3. That's the number of audio frames Tata generates per second of speech output. Most LLM-based speech systems operate at 12.5 to 75. The gap is not a benchmark win. It's a signal that something structurally different is happening. The problem Tata is solving is older than it looks. Audio is dense. 1 second of speech carries far more information than the text that produced it. When you force both into the same language model sequence, the audio tokens crowd out the text by an order of magnitude. The model loses track. It hallucinates words. It skips lines. It drifts. Current approaches paper over this by compressing audio into fewer frames or inserting intermediate semantic tokens, which buys back some efficiency at the cost of expressiveness, complexity, or both. Hume's approach is to drop the mismatch entirely. Tata aligns audio representations directly to text token. One continuous acoustic vector per text token. The model steps through text and speech in lockstep. One token in, one acoustic frame out, because the mapping is structural, because it's enforced by construction rather than learned by training. Content errors become architecturally impossible. The model cannot skip a word it was never given room to skip. Tata ran over 1,000 test samples and produced 0 hallucinations. That result didn't come from careful dataset curation. It came from the shape of the thing. Run this forward 5 years. On device voice interfaces that require no cloud connection, generate speech at a real-time factor of 0.09. That's more than 10 times faster than real time. And cannot hallucinate content by design. The privacy implications alone are significant. The API dependency disappears. The latency drops to something indistinguishable from human response. The use cases that couldn't exist because of cost or connectivity or reliability start to become ordinary. The quality numbers are honest. 4.18 out of 5 on speaker similarity, 3.78 on naturalness, second overall in human evaluation. Achieved against systems trained on substantially more data, not leading on expressiveness yet, but competitive, and light enough to run on a phone. Code and pre-trained models are available now. Hume open sourced the whole thing. The architecture is documented. The weights are there. The tools exist. The knowledge is available. What happens next is an engineering problem. Moving on. One commenter read the README and typed three words, so it begins. They weren't wrong. They linked to Google's Alpha Evolve announcement from May. The system Google used to optimize its own infrastructure, two generations of models ago. The implication, what right now dash A I just open sourced. Google has been running internally for a while. That gap is worth sitting with. OTA kernel's premise is clean. Give it any PyTorch model. It profiles the model, finds which GPU kernels are bottlenecks, extracts them as standalone Triton kernels, then runs a loop, edit, benchmark, keep, or revert. Repeat. Forever. The orchestrator uses Amdahl's law to decide when to move on. Each experiment runs in about 90 seconds, 40 experiments an hour, 320 overnight. Now take the stated design principle all the way. The README says program.md. The document the agent reads is intentionally comprehensive so the agent can run 10 or more hours without getting stuck. Six tiers of optimization strategy. Decision frameworks for when to abandon a kernel. Crash handling. Amdahl's law. Reasoning baked in. You are writing an extremely thorough manual to prevent an AI from losing the plot. The humans encoded every decision tree, every heuristic, every edge case. The agent is the execution layer. Pull the principle to its limit and you notice autonomous AI research here means fast iteration on a human design search space, which is exactly what it should mean. The bottleneck in GPU optimization has never been the ideas. It's the tedium. Profile, tweak, benchmark, revert, document, move on. Autokernel removes the tedium. The 9 supported kernel types. MABMO, flash attention, fused MLP, rope embeddings, the whole modern stack. Now get iterated at machine speed against real correctness checks. With roofline analysis built in, that's genuinely useful. And it's open. The commenter who brought up llama.cpp has the right instinct. Point this at a code base with real hardware diversity, real user pressure, real quantization variants, and see what surfaces. The commenter asking about TVM's Ansor is tracking the right comparison too. Ansor automates scheduling. Autokernel automates iteration. Different approaches to the same mountain. What Google built for itself, you can run tonight. From kernel schedulers to language ecosystems, Story 8 brings that same open tools energy to Julia development, with an Emacs environment built the way Clojure devs have always done it. 1982, a symbolic 372 machine sits in an MIT lab running an image its users can reach into with bare hands. Modify a function while it executes, inspect any object in memory, redefine the environment mid-flight. The machine costs more than a house. It will be obsolete in a decade. Unix and C are coming, and in winning they will quietly deprecate this capability. The live image, the running system you can think inside of, not around. Four decades later, the Julia scientific computing community is building it back, Julia Snail is an Emacs package in the explicit lineage of Slime and Cider. The tools that kept this workflow alive in the Lisp and Clojure communities while the rest of the industry forgot it existed. The proposition is straightforward. Give Julia the same REPL-driven development experience. Load a file into a running process. Evaluate individual functions. Jump to definitions in a live session. Get plots in the buffer. SSH into a remote machine and have the session follow you through Emacs Tramp. The technical execution is careful. Earlier attempts to run Julia's REPL inside Emacs failed for a mundane reason. Emacs native terminal emulation is not good enough. Snail fixes this by embedding a real terminal emulator, either VTerm or EAT, so Julia's REPL runs with the performance it expects. On the Julia side, CST parser gives the package genuine understanding of code structure, which module a piece of code lives in, what's currently loaded, what's available for completion. The editor and the runtime share a model of the world. That's the Slime insight from 2003. It still works. The commenter who wants this for Haskell is tracking something real. The architecture is language agnostic. It requires a parser, a persistent process, and someone willing to write the bridge. Here is the comedy. 40 years of IDE development, decades of notebooks, language servers, hot reload plugins marketed as breakthroughs, and the workflow that fits how scientific discovery actually happens is a running image you can reach into. Hypothesize, run, inspect. Change the function. Run again, same process, same state. The Symbolics engineers understood this in 1982. The market moved on. Open source remembered. Julia Snail is the receipt. From a living idea 40 years in the making, to a mind that shaped the next 40, story 9. Every time I hit a performance ceiling on a system I'd built, my instinct was to tear it down and start over. Delete the slow thing. Replace it. That impulse is almost always wrong. Tony Hoare knew something about that. He knew it in 1960, when he had a faster algorithm than the one his employer asked him to build. He built the slower one first. Did the job, then said, "By the way, I think I have something better." That's the quick sort story. Not just the algorithm. The method, he won the sixpence wager. He was right. But what stays with me is what came before the wager. He finished the assigned work first. Professionalism before brilliance. Now, devil's advocate. You could argue Quicksort is the least interesting thing about Hoare's career, and you'd be half right. The algorithm ships in every standard library. Students memorize it for interviews. It's been taught so many times, it's almost inert. You stop seeing the thought behind it. But here's where that argument collapses. Quicksort is inseparable from the epistemology that produced it. Hoare didn't just write a faster sort, he spent decades on a harder question. How do we actually know a program is correct? Not does it pass tests, not does it compile. How do we prove it? That question became Hoare logic, the formal system for reasoning about program correctness that still underlies modern verification tools. He built the machinery of proof around the machinery of computation. The design quote circulating in the comments is worth sitting with. Two ways to build software. Either so simple the deficiencies are obviously absent, or so complicated the deficiencies aren't obvious. That's not a clever line. That's a diagnostic. Most systems fail the second way. Complexity hides the flaws. He spent his career trying to move engineering toward the first way. He studied classics and philosophy before he ever touched a computer. Military training in Russian. He demonstrated early machines at International Expo, which apparently meant being fluent enough to develop for them. That breadth is not incidental. It shows in how he thought. Hoare logic reads more like Aristotle than a compiler manual, precise, categorical, concerned with what can be known with certainty versus what cannot. Someone in the comments called him a gentle intellectual giant that tracks the quicksort wager story, which he apparently never tired of telling. Ends with him confirming the sixpence was actually paid out. He seemed delighted by this detail every time. 92 years. Tony Hoare died March 5th. He built the faster algorithm. He also built the tools to prove the faster algorithm was correct. That's the complete thought. What does it mean to build something that truly understands? Story 10. Yann LeCun just raised $1 billion to find out. A Turing Award winner just called the current trajectory of the entire AI industry complete nonsense. That's not a frustrated academic venting on the internet. That's Yann LeCun, the person who co-invented modern deep learning, who spent a decade building Meta's AI research division into one of the best in the world, who has more skin in this game than almost anyone alive, and he just raised $1 billion to prove a different path. His new company is AMI, pronounced like the French word for friend, based in Paris, with offices in Montreal, Singapore, and New York, valued at $3.5 billion on day one. The argument is built on most human cognition is not linguistic. It is physical. You understand a coffee cup because you've dropped one. Because you've felt the weight shift when it's full versus empty. Because your nervous system holds a model of fragility and gravity and surface tension. You did not learn that from reading sentences about coffee cups. LLMS, learn from text. Text is human communication about the world, compressed and filtered. Strip away the scaling arguments, the benchmark charts, the product announcements. And that's the actual constraint. A system trained on representations of reality is not the same as a system trained on reality itself. Word models work differently. They learn to predict what happens next in physical state space, not token space. They operate on causality, physics, time, consequence. The structure of how things actually behave. Meta's JEPA architecture was LeCun's early attempt at this inside a social media company with a different agenda. IME is what happens when that research gets its own mandate. The applications he's pointing at are telling: aircraft engines, biomedical, manufacturing, robotics. Domains where reality does not care about your benchmark. A model that simulates an aircraft engine under real operating conditions, predicting failure modes, optimizing for efficiency. That was never a language task. What TensorFlow is building is a bet that the next decade belongs to systems that understand causality, not correlation, persistent memory, grounded reasoning, physical intuition baked into the architecture from the start. Whether AMI delivers on that is genuinely open. But the first principles argument is sound, and it is being made by someone who earned the right to make it. The architecture of intelligence matters. $1 billion from investors who agree is not nothing. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for March 11th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Goen3 TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something that outlasts the moment. We'll see you back here tomorrow.